Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We are talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Chapter 9 of Book 9. Why is Kalganov so sad? Big change in everyone's attitude suddenly now that Mitya is guilty. What's going on there? Terrific said, everything is stacked up against Mitya. The evidence is overwhelming. I can't see much hope of him ever winning his upcoming trial. The officials treated him fairly as far as we can tell, and Mitya just kept on digging himself further and further into a hole of complete and utter fait accompli, whatever that means. A few chapters back, I was convinced it was going to be Smurdy as the culprit. His whole life seemed like a blueprint for a murderer. Now I'm not so sure. Mitch's dream in the last chapter before this one had a distinct touch of a holy fool and the ecstasy of life about it. It felt like Alyosha weeping into the ground with tears streaming down his face. It felt like Zossima's epiphanic moment after the duel, except that those were real events and not in a dream. But there's a thematic closeness to those two that I can't shake. This is not an easy read, and I feel a lot of the same frustrations that Anda has vented in the podcast. We read for many different reasons, and books are written for countless reasons too. My personal feeling is this: some books can contain a single line making the whole read worthwhile. Some books that on the surface are well made in their construction, plot and characters and language still manage to fall flat. I'm still unsure where to place this book, but it has certainly made me think and feel things, and that's usually a good sign. As to why Kalganov is sad, he is from a Musov family that Mitya grew up with. I can't imagine the sadness if one of my family members stood accused of a crime such as this one. It's his family member. I didn't realise it was his family member. I think I just kind of forgot. It's interesting to see that you are feeling some of the frustrations I'm feeling. That's always reassuring, although I think not to the extent that I am feeling them, because I've been flying off the handle a little bit. But thanks for saying that anyway. Somastar says, I still have faith in a plot twist. Fingers crossed for a plot twist, eh? Laura Stitch, Y Stitch said, We are now two-thirds of the way through the book. There's still plenty of time for more things to happen. I Am Norwegian says, wow, good memory. I have completely forgotten about who it was that raised the boys, with the exception of Grigory and some vague mention of the aunts for Alyosha. I Am Norwegian also said, Grushenka actually didn't care about Fyodor. She was just toying with him to upset Mitya. Gentlemen, we are cruel. We are all monsters. We are all suffering to people, to mothers and their infants. Seems like the dream might have a lasting impact on Mitya. I'd almost forgotten about it, but the same thing, although much more powerfully, happened to Alyosha in his dream. I'd like to know why Kalganov was sad too. He was introduced at the monastery and is related to the arrogant intellectual Musov. I know he's had pieces of dialogue during the party chapters, but I didn't really pay much attention to what he said. At the time, I didn't even really remember who he was. It was Kalganov who revealed the cheating at cards to Mitya. I went through the book, control-effing Kalganov. I think he might just be apologising about his clothes being too small for Dmitri. Last mention of him was that it was his clothes that Mitya got to borrow after the officials took his. Right. Okay, that clears that up a little bit. Alright. That's the conversation. We've done it. We've done the having of the conversation about Chapter 9. Now it's time to move on to Chapter 1 of Book 10, which is the start of Part 4. Book 10 is called The Boys, and Chapter 1 is called Kolya Krasotkin. It was the beginning of November. There had been a hard frost, 11 degrees, Remur without snow. But a little dry snow had fallen on the frozen ground during the night, and a keen dry wind was lifting and blowing it along the dreary streets of our town, especially about the marketplace. It was a dull morning, but the snow had ceased. Not far from the marketplace, close to Plotnikov's shop, There stood a small house, very clean, both without and within. It belonged to Madame Krasotkin, the widow of a former provincial secretary who had been dead for 14 years. His widow, still a nice-looking woman of 30, was living in her neat little house on her private means. She lived in a respectable seclusion. She was of a soft but fairly cheerful disposition. She was about 18 at the time of her husband's death. She had been married only a year and had just borne him a son. From the day of his death, she had devoted herself, heart and soul, to the bringing up of her precious treasure, her boy, Kolya. Though she had loved him passionately those 14 years, he had caused her more suffering than happiness. She had been trembling and fainting with terror almost every day, afraid he would fall ill, would catch a cold, do something naughty, climb on a chair and fall off, and so on and so on. When Kolya began going to school, the mother devoted herself to studying all the sciences with him, so as to help him and go through his lessons with him. She hastened to make the acquaintance of the teachers and their wives, even made up to Kolya's schoolfellows and fawned upon them in the hope of thus saving Kolya from being teased, laughed at, or beaten by them. She went on so far that the boys actually began to mock at him on her account and taunt him with being a mother's darling. But the boy could take his own part. He was a resolute boy, tremendously strong, as was rumoured in his class, and soon proved to be the fact. He was agile, strong-willed, and of an audacious and enterprising temper. He was good at lessons, and there was a rumour in the school that he could beat the teacher, Dardanelov, at arithmetic and universal history. Though he looked down upon everyone, he was a good comrade and not supercilious. He accepted his schoolfellows' respect as his due, but was friendly with them. Above all, he knew where to draw the line. He could restrain himself on occasion, and in his relations with his teachers he never overstepped that last mystic limit beyond which a prank becomes an unpardonable breach of discipline. But he was as fond of mischief on every possible occasion as the smallest boy in the school, and not so much for the sake of mischief as for creating a sensation, inventing something effective and conspicuous. He was extremely vain. He knew how to make even his mother give way to him. He was almost despotic in his control of her. She gave way to him. Oh, she had given way to him for years. The one thought unendurable to her was that her boy had no great love for her. She was always fancying that Kolya was unfeeling to her, and at times, dissolving into hysterical tears, she used to reproach him with his coldness. The boy disliked this, and the more demonstrations of feeling were demanded of him, the more he seemed intentionally to avoid them. Yet it was not intentional on his part, but instinctive. It was his character. His mother was mistaken. He was very fond of her. He only disliked sheepish sentimentality, as he expressed it in his schoolboy language. There was a bookcase in the house containing a few books that had been his father's. Kolya was fond of reading, and had read several of them by himself. His mother did not mind that, and only wondered sometimes at seeing the boy stand for hours by the bookcase poring over a book instead of going to play. And, in that way, Kolya read some things unsuitable for his age. Though the boy, as a rule, knew where to draw the line in his mischief, he had of late begun to play pranks that caused his mother serious alarm. It is true there was nothing vicious in what he did, but a wild, mad recklessness. It happened that July, during the summer holidays, that the mother and son went to another district, 45 miles away, to spend a week with a distant relation whose husband was an official at the railway station, the very station the nearest one to our town, from which a month later Ivan Fyodorovich Karamazov set off for Moscow. There, Kolya began by carefully investigating every detail connected with the railways, knowing that he could impress his schoolfellows when he got home with his newly acquired knowledge, but there happened to be some other boys in the place with whom he soon made friends. Some of them were living in the station, others in the neighbourhood. There were 6 or 7 of them, all between 12 and 15, and 2 of them came from our town. The boys played together, and on the 4th or 5th day of Kolya's stay at the station, a mad bet was made by the foolish boys. Kolya, who was also the youngest of the party and rather looked down upon by the others in consequence, was, moved by vanity or by reckless bravado, to bet them 2 rubles that he would lie down between the rails that night when the 11 o'clock train was due and would lie there without moving while the train rolled over him at full speed. It was true they made a preliminary investigation from which it appeared that it was possible to lie flat between the rails, that the train could pass over without touching, but to lie there was no joke. Collier maintained stoutly that he would. At first they laughed at him, called him a little liar, a braggart, but that only egged him on. What piqued him most was that these boys of 15 turned up their noses at him too, superciliously, and were at first disposed to treat him as a small boy, not fit to associate with them, and that was an unendurable insult. And so it was resolved to go in the evening, 1/2 mile from the station, so that the train might have time to get up to full speed after leaving the station. The boys assembled. It was pitch dark night without a moon. At the time fixed, Collier lay down between the rails. The 5 others who had taken the bet waited among the bushes below the embankment, their hearts beating with suspense, which was followed by an alarm and remorse. At last they heard in the distance the rumble of the train leaving the station. 2 red lights gleamed out of the darkness. The monster roared as it approached. Run away from the rails, the boy cried to Collier from the bushes, breathless with terror. But it was too late. The train darted up and flew past. The boys rushed to Collier. He was lying without moving. They began pulling at him, lifting him up, and suddenly he got up and walked away without a word. Then he explained that he had lain there as though he were insensible to frighten them. But the fact was that he really had lost consciousness, as he confessed long after to his mother. In this way, his reputation as a desperate character was established forever. He returned home to the station as white as a sheet. Next day he had a slight attack of nervous fever, but he was in high spirits and well pleased with himself. The incident did not become known at once, but when they came back to the town, it penetrated to the school and even reached the ears of the masters. But then Collier's mother hastened to entreat the masters on her boy's behalf, and in the end, Dardanelov, a respected and influential teacher, exerted himself in his favour, and the affair was ignored. Dardanelov was a middle-aged bachelor, who had been passionately in love with Madame Krasotkin for many years past, and had once already, about a year previously, ventured, trembling with fear and the delicacy of his sentiments, to offer her, most respectfully, his hand in marriage. But she refused him resolutely, feeling that to accept him would be an act of treachery to her son, though Dardanelov had, to judge from certain mysterious symptoms, reason for believing that he was not an object of aversion to the charming but too chaste and tender-hearted widow. Collier's mad prank seemed to have broken the ice, and Dardanelov was rewarded for his intercession by a suggestion of hope. The suggestion, it is true, was a faint one, but then Dardanelov was such a paragon of purity and delicacy that it was enough for the time being to make him perfectly happy. He was fond of the boy, though he would have felt it beneath him to try and win him over, and was severe and strict with him in class. Collier, too, kept him at a respectful distance. He learned his lessons perfectly. He was second in his class. He was reserved with Dardanelov, and the whole class firmly believed that Collier was so good at universal history that he could beat even Dardanelov. Collier did indeed ask him the question, who founded Troy, to which Dardanelov had made a very vague reply, referring to the movements and migration of races and to the remoteness of the period, to the mythical legends. But the question, who had founded Troy, that is, what individuals, he could not answer, and even for some reason regarded the question as idle and frivolous. But the boys remained convinced that Dardanelov did not know who founded Troy. Collier had read of the founders of Troy in Smaragdov, whose history was among the books in his father's bookcase. In the end, all the boys became interested in the question, who it was that had founded Troy, but Krasotkin would not tell his secret, and his reputation for knowledge remained unshaken. After the incident on the railway, a certain change came over Collier's attitude to his mother. When Anna Fyodorovna, Madame Krasotkin, heard of her son's exploit, she almost went out of her mind with horror. She had such terrible attacks of hysterics, lasting with intervals for several days, that Collier, seriously alarmed at last, promised on his honour that such pranks would never be repeated. He swore on his knees before the holy image, and swore by the memory of his father at Madame Krasotkin's instance. And the manly Collier burst into tears like a boy of six. And all that day the mother and son were constantly rushing into each other's arms, sobbing. Next day Collier woke up as unfeeling as before, but he had become more silent, more modest, sterner and more thoughtful. 6 weeks later, it is true, he got up into another scrape, which even brought his name to the ears of our justice of the peace, but it was a scrape of quite another kind. Amusing, foolish, and he did not, as it turned out, take the leading part in it, but was only implicated in it. But of this later. His mother still fretted and trembled, but the more uneasy she became, the greater were the hopes of Dar Denilov. It must be noted that Kolya understood and divined what was in Dardanelov's heart, and of course despised him profoundly for his feelings. He had in the past been so tactless as to show his contempt before his mother, hinting vaguely that he knew that Dardanelov was after. But from the time of the railway incident, his behaviour in this respect also was changed. He did not allow himself the remotest allusion to the subject, and began to speak more respectfully of Dardanelov before his mother, which the sensitive woman at once appreciated with boundless gratitude. But at the slightest mention of Dardanelov by a visitor in Kolya's presence, she would flush as pink as a rose. At such moments, Kolya would either stare out of the window, scowling, or would investigate the state of his boots, or would shout angrily for Perez von, the big, shaggy, mangy dog, which he had picked up a month before, brought home, and kept for some reason secretly indoors, not showing him to any of his schoolfellows. He bullied him frightfully, teaching him all sorts of tricks, so that the poor dog howled for him whenever he was absent at school, and when he came in, whined with delight, rushed about as if he were crazy, begged, and lay down on the ground pretending to be dead, and so on. In fact, showed all the tricks he had taught him, not at the word of a command, but simply from the zeal of his excited and grateful heart. I have forgotten, by the way, to mention that Kolya Krasotkin was the boy stabbed with a penknife by the boy already known to the reader as the son of Captain Snegoryov. Ilyusha had been defending his father when the schoolboys jeered at him, shouting the nickname Wisp of Tow. All right, there we go. That's the end of chapter one. Very cool. Have your say over at reddit.com/r/TheHemingwayList. I feel like that was significant, who that character was, but I'm not really sure who that character was because I just forget all the characters in this book. Is that the boy whose dad... No, is that the boy that was throwing rocks at Alyosha? Is that who that is? Is that... I think I might have that right, actually. But I'll have to confirm that via the subreddit. Now, tomorrow's episode might be posted a bit early because my band is playing a gig tomorrow night, so I've got to get out of here a bit early. So I think rather than do it when I get home, which will be really late, I'll do it before I go out so that just makes my evening a little bit less... A little bit easier. Because when you get home from a gig and it's, you know, whatever time, 2 in the morning or whenever, and you're exhausted and you're sweaty and all the rest, it's, it's kind of not the best time to sit down and do a podcast. So I'll do it before I leave. But that just means that I'll be recording it. Usually I record it at about, something around midnight, my time. I'll be doing it something more like about 5 o'clock. So that gives you a good 7 hours or so less to get your comments in. So if your comments get cut off, I'll just put them in the next episode is all I'll do. So it won't make much difference. But yeah, just sort of give you the heads up. Other than that, thank you for listening. I will see you tomorrow.